Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Israeli author David Grossman. He's joined in conversation by Rachel Handler. And now join Rachel Handler as she introduces David Grossman.
Good afternoon. I'm Jessica Handler, and I'm the author and creative writing professor at Oglethorpe University. On behalf of the Marcus JCC and the National JCC Literary Consortium, I am so pleased to welcome you to this very special Bookfest in Your Living Room event featuring the international best-selling author David Grossman. We will be discussing his wonderful new book, More Than I Love My Life. But first, a little bit about our honored guest. David Grossman was born in Jerusalem and is the author of numerous works of fiction, nonfiction, and children's literature. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker and has been translated into more than 40 languages. He's the recipient of many prizes, including the French Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres, the Man Booker International Prize, and the Albatross Prize given by the Günter Grass Foundation. So live from Jerusalem, please welcome David Grossman.
Hi, good evening. Good evening, Jessica. Good
evening, David.
Hi.
Hi, David. What I want to do is, we talked a minute ago, and you're going to be reading for us in a little while. So we're not going to start out with a reading from More Than I Love My Life, which is a wonderful book. But I want to ask you, the story was inspired in part by someone you knew. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was inspired, and especially the character of Vera, the lady who is 90 years old, and she is the engine of the whole book and the whole events. And one day she called me, and she wanted to talk about something that I wrote in the past. And I was fascinated first by her accent. It was a very unusual mixture of Hebrew, Hungarian, and Serbo-Croatian accent, but also by her personality, which was very decisive and self-assured and authoritative personality. Hard as a rock when it came to ideals and values, and soft and tender when it came to human beings. And she told me, at my request, she told me her story. And we became friends for 20 years, the last 20 years of her life. We met when she was 77. She died when she was 97, almost 7 years ago. And in these 20 years, she told me her story, which is almost unbelievable story, very extreme story, again and again and again, as if she felt that whenever she tells it, she will understand something more about it. And from the very beginning, she asked if I'm going to write a book about her. And I said, look, Eva, her name was Eva, Eva Panich Nahir. Look, Eva, I want to write about you. But first, I never decide to write about something. I write when it's inevitable, then I write. And second, I'm not a documentarist. I wrote some documentary books, but I'm a fiction writer, and I will not write you exactly as you are one to one, but I will also imagine you and invent you and recreate you in a way that will never be contradictory to the real you, but it will be as something that could have happened to you. And she immediately accepted it. And I was writing down every meeting that we had and every phone call, and we had quite a lot. And I think I learned to capture her special, not only personality, but the melody of her talk and the way she emphasized certain things and the way she used the Hebrew of a refugee. You know, the generation of our parents, they came from the Shoah, they came from over there, they came from the diaspora. And we were quite embarrassed, we the children, quite embarrassed and even ashamed that our children will hear our parents talking with their funny, distorted, broken Hebrew. It was a broken language of broken people. And I think that in this book, I hope I did some correction, some repairing for this shame or embarrassment that we felt. And I give her a voice. I give her voice, a place to be. And part of the reactions to the book in Israel was of people my age who said what I just now told you about how we treated our parents and how relieved they are now when this language gets a legitimacy in this book and even in the title. The title of the book in Hebrew is different from the title in English. And it's something like, with me, life plays a lot. Iti ha'chayim meshachek harbeh. And everyone who hears it in Israel knows exactly who is saying that, who is the type who is using this this vocabulary, this syntax.
This kind of syntax. And we talked a little bit, I'm very curious about the characters and their dynamics and what they do and don't tell each other, both literally out of their mouths and in their behaviors. And I hadn't really, you write about Vera's accent and how Gili, who is her granddaughter, and other people around her interpret how she speaks and the way she fills the world with speech. And I'm curious about building a character. I mean, some of the characters, Nina, Vera, Gili, this is a three generations of women, they're so intertwined and so complicated with each other. Can you talk about building a character and characters who aren't always, to use the English, cuddly and sweet? These are complicated people.
Yeah. Like in life, yes. Yeah. We are all complicated. Most of us are complicated people, even those who deny that. And yes, it's three very strong, very opinionate, very critical women who are going on a trip together to solve something, to understand something, to touch the wound that torments all the three of them for so many years. How to create a character? Well, I think, first of all, it's to build something out of thousands of small details and nuances. And to see if it fits, and even if it does not fit, it's also possible. Because we are not homogeneous creatures. We are full of inner contradictions. And of course, everything starts with the language, because the language is one of the most intimate signatures that we live in, that we create in our life. And everyone almost has a special language of his or her own. We do not necessarily notice it, and we think that most of us speak alike, but it's not like that. Everyone has his or her emphases, melody, as I said before, vocabulary, idioms that we use or things that we never use, slang that is typical for us. And if you listen carefully, suddenly the character can start to emerge. I always like to tell the story about what I had with my character, Ora. Ora, the protagonist of To the End of the Land. Mm-hmm. She's a 50 years old Israeli, and she's going on a trip, like the trip in More Than I Love My Life, but a different one.
Yeah.
And I was writing her for 2.5 years, and I was unable to break through. I felt I knew all the details about her, but the spirit was not there. And I know when it's there, because my wish, my really desire is that I will know my character, you know, like Adam knew Eve, to really prevail totally in her. And I did not have this feeling with Oa. So in the end, out of despair, because I felt that if I will not get to know her better, I'll have to give up on the book. So I just did, out of despair, a strange act. I wrote her a story. I took a pen and a paper and an envelope, not a mail, not computer. And I started to write her, "Dear Oa," I wrote, "why are you like that? Lamat kazot? Why don't you surrender to me?" And I tell you, the moment I wrote, "Why don't you surrender to me?" Suddenly it struck me how stupid I am, because it's not she who has to surrender to me. It's me who has to surrender to her and to this specific woman and to the optional woman inside me. And once I said it to myself in this way, everything fell into its place. And suddenly she was alive. She was ignited and she was full of life and vitality. And she pulled me behind her. So that was one of the most very sharp examples of how to create a character, how to stop fighting with it, how to allow the character to prevail inside me and to not to impose on the character my inner constitution, because this is the easiest thing, but to allow her inner constitution to surface. And then suddenly there is something almost like flesh and blood in front of you.
Yeah. You must go through life very much as a listener and an observer, which is what makes a good writer, is eavesdropping.
Yes, and the world is full with stories. You know, it's amazing how the air is full of stories, and especially being in Israeli, because every Jew who survived the Shoah, for example, the Holocaust, is a miracle. And it's an unbelievable, incredible story. And the people here, because of the extremity of life, because of the constant drama in which we live, people are stories, are walking stories, sometimes too much. Sometimes I think people here think that they are a larger than life story. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, even the way Israel looks at itself, it looks as if it's a larger than life story. And in a way, we are right. We are a larger than life story because of all the things that the Jewish people went through. But I wish for a time that we shall be just man-sized, human-sized story.
But you
asked about the storytelling. Mm-hmm. And almost in every book that I've written, there is a person telling a story to another person. And the other person mostly is a good attentive person and someone who will listen very carefully and echo in an appropriate way and in a deep, profound way. And I learned something. I learned that every one of us, we have our official story. The story that we learned how to tell about ourselves in a way that will gain us the sympathy of the listener, the love of the listener, the mercy sometimes of the listener. Mm-hmm. And over the years, we learned to polish and to perfect this official formal story of us, this visit card of us, to an extent that we know how to do it. We are wonderful actors in the way we tell our story. But maybe it will be very wise to look and to understand how much this official story of us has imprisoned us, how much it blocks us and paralyzes us and do not allow us to, you know, to breathe with both lungs or to develop ourselves, because maybe we are already in another, totally another place. Yeah. Not in the place where we were when we started to create this official story.
This official maybe, story.
Yeah, maybe we can move a little and see our official story from the eyes of our mama, our father. Maybe we understand that also mama had a mama of her own, or that our father has the right for psychology. It's not only us, the very sophisticated people, also our parents, they have the right for psychology, very complicated, very in a contradictory of their own. And of course, you know, it applies to individuals, but it applies also to countries, to nations, mm-hmm. because every nation has its legislative story, legislative myth, and they tell it again and again, and they bring up children on the knees of this official story.
Of this official story, yeah.
But maybe it's important I'll conclude by that, to ask ourselves, do these stories help us? Are they really paving the way for us for the future? Or maybe they just stuck us deeper and deeper in the relationship with our neighbors, our enemies. Maybe it's about time to allow the narrative of the enemy to infiltrate into our own inner systems. Maybe we should understand more about ourselves, because it is the enemy who sees things in us that we prefer not to see. Yeah. So it sounds very complicated, but it's something very natural, because to tell a story is just, you know, to listen to it, to allow the story take over you. What else do we need? I mean, just follow
it. You do a really interesting thing with this, and I want to kind of talk about how stories are made and how this book is almost a series of stories within stories. I'm turning a story here. Two things happen. Well, something happens on a lexical level, and granted, I've read this in translation in English, but my hope is that this holds true for the original as well. There's a world of difference in the phrasing that went to Goli Otok and was put in Goli Otok. And this is something I think that Gili, the granddaughter, ruminates on. And I'd like you to talk to us about what was Goli Otok, and if I'm mispronouncing it, and also how the interpretation between one character hearing you went to as opposed to you were put in.
Yeah. Goli Otok was one of the gulags that Marshal Tito, the leader of Yugoslavia, has created around the end of the 40s, the beginning of the 50s of the previous century. Mm-hmm. He did it because he started to suspect that Stalin, the Russian leader, plans to invade into Yugoslavia. So he took all the people he suspected to be supporters of Stalin, communists, socialists, and put them in such camps, such gulags, that were re-education camps, but actually they were almost like extermination camp. It was such a terrible, horrible places. I visited them twice. I was twice on the Goli Otok. Goli Otok, the name is the naked island, and it was naked because no vegetation was possible there. Now it's a little different. Trees have been planted, some bushes. It looks a little different. But I tell you, it is, you know, like hell, like you imagine hell. The brutality of the violence that has been performed there still radiates until now. And you feel, I mean, it's a place that I spend there only 2 days. I don't know how Eva Panichnayir spent there three years. And how she survived the hard labor. You know, she had to roll a rock against the slope of a hill. And she, I asked her, how did you do it? Because she was a very tiny lady. She was, her weight was something like 40 or 45 kilos all her life. And the rocks were much heavier than her. And I said, how were you able to push it? And she said, I told myself a story. I said, I said that my daughter Tiana is on the top of the hill. No, sorry, that my daughter Tiana is very, very sick. And her medication is in a pharmacy on the top of the hill. And I have to go there with the rock. And she rolled the rock till the top of the hill. And there was the pharmacist who gave her the medication. And then she went back, which was not less dangerous because sometimes the rocks crushed the people who pushed them. And she got to Tiana in at the feet of the hill. She gave her the medication and again turned the rock and started to roll it again because Tiana is sick and Tiana needs medication 12 hours a day for several months. Can you imagine?
And you use you use a version of that. You give that to Vera, right?
Yes. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. And she got to Goli Otok. She was sent there. She was deported there. She had no, well, I cannot say she had no control on that because had she collaborated with the secret service of Tito, she would have been spared from all these atrocities, but she did not want to be spared. And in a way, and what her daughter and granddaughter discovered in this trip, she was sent to Goli Otok because she refused to collaborate with the Secret Service. And she had the chance, she had the option of not collaborating, collaborate, yes.
Yeah.
And she did not want to work with them because she felt that if she will not remain loyal to her husband and if she will not declare him, if she declares him as the enemy of the people, as she was asked to do, no one will protect him. No one will save his honor. And so she chose to be loyal to him and not to her daughter because her daughter was left alone when Vera was sent to Goli Otok. She was 6 years old.
And that's Nina.
That's Nina, yeah. Mm-hmm. Her name is Tiana, and she lives in San Francisco. A very remarkable woman. She also helped me a lot in writing the story, especially writing the character of Eva, of Vera.
You're listening to Israeli author David Grossman, whose new novel is More Than I Love My Life. He's joined in conversation by Rachel Handler on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kaalw.org.
Was that difficult for her, for Tiana, to kind of recall her mother's life and some of the sacrifices that her mother made? And as you have it in this book, miscommunication between mother, daughter, and grandmother. So was it difficult for Tiana to bring this back?
It was very difficult, and yet she did it. And she herself with her daughter, Emily, and with her mother, Eva, mm-hmm. They all went to a trip to Goli Otok. And on Goli Otok, she asked her mother, would you do it again? Now, when you know the subsequences of such act that you did, will you do it again? And her mother immediately said, yes. And that was a shocking moment, I must say, because... Yeah. But I understand her. I think... Had she admitted that she would not have done it again, she will fall into parts. She will crumble. All her life were cast around this harsh decision, this tragic decision. And what I hope that my readers will do is to read it with some generosity, not to judge her immediately for what she did. This is the easiest thing. But to try to understand in what period she lived. And she herself, she told me, you cannot understand. You live in a time that the human being is more important than ideas. I lived in a time where ideas were more important. And she was right. And I tried to bring myself to this feeling, to this moral climate. Yeah. And again, not to judge her, not to be her social worker, not to be her psychologist or teacher. But just to allow her to be the way she is. And I must tell you that when Tiana, the daughter, heard what she said, what her mother said, she said, you see, this is why I love mother. This is why I love her, because she will never lie. She will never beautify things.
There's mothering and honesty are a huge element, a real through line in this book. And you were talking about that Goli Otok had no vegetation. It's called Bald Island, Naked Island. Vera has to, in a way, mother one piece of vegetation, doesn't she?
Yes, I hesitate if to give it away here.
Yeah, we don't want to do that. But let's take a bigger lens and say, mothering to me is a through line in this book. So, what is the role of mothering in this narrative? And even Raphael, I think it is, talks about dividing the world into mothers and non-mothers. And Raphael is a son; he's a man. So talk to me about the role of mothering / parenting in this narrative. It seems very important to how the characters interact.
It is the heart of the matter, because both Gilly and Nina have been abandoned by their mothers. So motherhood gets here a very harsh test. Mm. What does it mean that they are the mothers of these abandoned children? But I think that, you know, it's so, I mean, the zone of women and their mothers is such a condensed zone. I think one of the most condensed human zones ever. And I'm very careful when I enter this place. But I think that what I try to show is different kinds of motherhood, also a motherhood performed by a man, by Rafi, mm-hmm. which is maybe is the most mothery of them all. And I needed him, and I needed his softness and understanding, and the way he contained all the three women around him, and he's serving like a lightning rod for all the three of them. So I cannot define it, but I know motherhood when I meet one.
Yes. As does Rafi, right? As does Rafi.
As is Rafi, yes. But how would you define motherhood?
How would I define motherhood?
Yes, yes.
Well, beyond the obvious biology of giving birth to another human being, I would say mothering is not only nurturing and caring for, but as you pointed out, as you related Tiana saying, being honest, being straightforward about things that matter. And I don't know if that's mothering or just good parenting, you know, gender aside. Yeah. What do you think?
I think it just shows us how amazing this human creation of the family, how rich and multi-layered it is, and how it is an unfolding story that goes all throughout all our lives, and not always we understand it. And I always feel that the greatest or the most significant moments in humanity, they have not occurred in palaces and not in corridors of parliaments and not on battlefields, but in kitchens and in bedrooms and in children's rooms. There was the real drama of mankind. Yes, and I think, you know, I'm reading the Bible weekly. I belong to a little group of three people who meets every Tuesday or Sunday to 3 hours of reading the Bible. We are meeting for now, it's 31 years already. And I'm a non-believer. I'm absolutely a secularist. And yet I read the Bible as Jews did throughout history with a magnifying glass. You know, sometimes we can stay on one sentence or one paragraph for a month. And when you read the book of Genesis and you see all the diversity of the familial connections, when you think that the first siblings, one of them murdered the other one, or there were only four people on earth and one already murdered
the other one. Yeah, leaving us with three, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And when we think of all the structures that are described in the book of Genesis, the relationship between siblings, the attitude of the brothers toward Joseph, the fact that we are all made of the materials of fathers and mothers, and what does it mean, and how we in our behavior, how we echo them or contradict them, all this is, it's an ongoing bubbling situation. I'm so attracted to write about families. All my books are about families. There is no bigger drama than that.
Well, you've just touched on a comment from Gloria Feisenthal. And Gloria, if I mispronounce your surname, call me out on it. But Gloria says, talking about motherhood, I think, isn't it a universal theme in literature, or honor? Is the honor a universal theme in literature? And then Gloria says, be true to yourself. And then Gloria references Antigone, which I've just finished teaching again. So yeah, so the comment from Gloria is it a universal theme in literature to your mind?
What is a literature?
Honor, being true to yourself within the family.
Well, it's a kind of a wish, but do we succeed in it? I'm not sure. And maybe that's what creates the greatest literary or artistic creations, the places that we do not rise up to our expectations, to our morality, to many other things.
Mm-hmm. We have another question, and then I'm going to ask this question, and then I have a question for you about some of the structure in the book. A person who is here as anonymous attendee says, how do you decide who will translate your books, and do you look at the translations to see if they hold true to the original Hebrew text?
First of all, it's not me who decide. I'm one of the of a group of people who decide to get samples from different people. I'm very lucky. I'm working with Jessica Cohen now, I think, for 7 or 8 books. And I think that she feels the melody in which I write. Every writer has a melody of his or her own. And by the way, literature is very much about music, about the rhythm, about stopping in certain places, repeating, crescendo. Everything is very musical in the writing.
Musical. And a good translator gets the feel and the rhythm and the sense of the author's musicality.
Exactly.
Are you a musician? You speak like one.
No, I'm a good listener to music, but not a musician myself. Thank you.
Okay.
But after the translator is being chosen by my editors, by my publisher, by me, by my agent, Deborah Harris, the interesting thing is that, first of all, you can just hope that the translator will be so attentive and will be able to recreate you in his or her language. But To make that more sure, I invented some method. I gather my translators. Sometimes it was 12, sometimes it was 15. And we all sat for almost a week, 5 days, in a little town in the on the border between Holland and Germany. It's called Strahlen, this little town. And there is a center for translation there. And we sit there every day, 12 hours, and we read the book. I read the book to them from A to Z. I read a paragraph and then I pause, and then they start to consult among themselves. And we made them sit around the round table, but we made them sit according to the sister languages, you know, the German near the Dutch, and the Dutch near the Swedish, and the Slovakian near the Czech, and the Czech near the Romanian. So they were able to converse among themselves, the Catalan with the Spanish, and they had to find solutions to all kinds of problems. For example, just stupid thing. In Hebrew, the fetus has one word, ubar. There is one word for the fetus of that is in the belly of the woman. Yeah. But in many languages, there are three different words to three phases of pregnancy. I was not aware of that. I will never forget this moment when my German translator, Anne Birkenau, she said about something that I wrote. She said, no, this is too emotional. It's really, no, so she said, no, this is too sentimental. It's almost kitsch what you wrote here. And immediately the Italian and the Catalan and the Spanish translator just jumped on her and said, no, it's not sentimental, it's emotional, it's just the right temperature. So you could see how the idea of the translation, which is a strange idea, how is it possible? How is it possible that I write a sentence that echoed the Bible or the Talmud or the updated Israeli slang, and Jessica finds the exact equivalent to it in English, or somebody finds the exact equivalent in Chinese? How is it possible? What do they read? What do we read when we read translation? I don't know. But the fact is that it works. In the end, we all grew up on translations. We read wonderful translations.
We've got a question here about the difference about the Hebrew title and how it differs from the English translation. And you and I, before we started, you mentioned you were going to read a short piece from the book in Hebrew so we can get a sense of that. So I wonder if you would do that for us and then address the question of how is the Hebrew title different from the English translation of Sam?
Okay, thank you for allowing the Hebrew to echo there. I will read from the very beginning of the book. רפאל היה בן 15 כשמתה אימא שלו וגאלה אותו מיסוריה. גשם ירד על חברי הקיבוץ שהצטופפו תחת מטריות בבית הקברות הקטן. טוביה, אביו של רפאל, מרר בבכי. שנים טיפל באשתו במסירות, ועכשיו נראה אבוד ומיותם. רפאל, במכנסיים קצרים, עמד נבדל מהאחרים וכיסה את ראשו ואת עיניו בקפוצ'ון, שלא יראו שהוא לא בוכה. הוא חשב, עכשיו שהיא מתה, היא יכולה לראות את כל הדברים שחשבתי עליה. זה היה בחורף 1962. אחרי שנה פגש אבא שלו את ורה נובק, שבאה לארץ מיוגוסלביה, והם התחילו לחיות כזוג. ורה הגיעה לארץ עם ביתה היחידה נינה, נערה בת 17, גבוהה, בהירת שיער, שבפנים הארוכות שלה שהיו חברות ויפות מאוד, כמעט לא הייתה הבאה. נערים בכיתה של רפאל קראו לנינה ספינקס, היו מתגנבים מאחוריה ומחכים אותה בהליכתה, מחבקת את גופה בזרועותיה ובוהה במבט חלול. הייתה פעם שהיא תפסה שני חבר'ה שחיכו אותה, ופשוט פוצצה להם את הפרצוף. מכות כאלה עוד לא ראו בקיבוץ. היה קשה להאמין כמה כוח ופראות היו לה בזרועות הדקיקות שלה. התחילו לרוץ שמועות, סיפרו שבזמן שאימא שלה הייתה אסירה פוליטית בגולג, נזרקה נינה, שהייתה אז ילדה, לרחוב. אמרו לרחוב והוסיפו מבט רב משמעות. סיפרו שהצטרפה בבלגרד לכנופיה של ילדי פרא שחטפה ילדים כדי לקבל כופר. That's it.
Thank you so much. That is just, I'm going to applaud on behalf of everybody. I was reading along in English because I have almost no Hebrew, and it's beautiful and has very distinct rhythm. And I find markers in the English words that I know. So I'm like, okay, I know where we are. Cheryl wants to know, how is the title different in Hebrew and English?
In English, it's More Than I Love My Life. And in Hebrew is With Me Life Plays a Lot. Both of them are quotations of Eva Panichna here. But somehow, More Than I Love My Life in English sounds better than in Hebrew. And so is With Me Life Plays a Lot. It sounds very good or very typical, as I explained before, in Hebrew. But it, somehow it's not attractive, I guess, in English. So usually I leave my publish my editors to choose the name because I think they have a better understanding, deep understanding of the language. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah. So you're trusting your translator and you're trusting your editors and you're trusting the people who are handling the story out in the world. Yeah. Speaking of stories out in the world, the Dallas JCC, hi Dallas, says there's so many stories out there. And how do you decide what to write next, or do the stories find you?
Wow, what a wonderful story, because usually I have more than one story that I really very much want to write. And it takes me sometimes months to decide which one of the three, four, five good ideas, which one will be my spouse in the next 3 years. And I cannot decide. It's very strange, because in the past, when I imposed my decision and chose one story, it fell after a while. It dropped. And I was unable to write it anymore. It has to come from the stories, from the competing stories. And always one of them breakthrough, and I learned to trust it. You know, if one of them is really breaking through, when suddenly I feel against what I felt before I thought, wow, why this idea? It's not mine. It's not relevant to me. But when it really breaks through, I understand that it is so relevant to me. It is so unloyal to me in a productive way. It is so not collaborating with my fears, my inhibitions, my little interests in life. And it takes me beyond my borders. And then I just follow it. And then I know it's the right decision.
I like that you say spouse, because I tell my students, particularly my advanced students who are working on drafts of novellas or things like that, I say, this is a story you're going to be married to for an extended period of time. So do you like it? Are you going to get along? You know, how you feel about each other? So,
yeah. You're absolutely right. Because like in good marriage, the book will change you and you will change the book.
Yeah.
You will not come from the back cover as you were when you started the book.
You are changed and your readers are changed by good work. I've got two questions for you sort of on that subject. In this story, the family goes to Goli Otok to sort of come to terms with what happened to Vera and the decisions that people made. And I don't want to give anything away, but structurally, Raphael is a filmmaker, and Gili, his daughter, works with him in filmmaking. And so they undertake to make kind of a home movie, a documentary about Vera's story. So first of all, you really know your way around filmmaking. I mean, your language is really accurate in this. But why choose this framing device for how the family reveals their truths? Why filmmaking?
I needed another layer of reality, I think. And the camera adds this additional layer. Mm-hmm. And there is always a competition between Gili, the young filmmaker, and her father, Rafael, the old filmmaker. They all the time compete about who will shoot now, who will use the camera now. And there start to be all kind of relationship between all the four participants, the three women and Rafael, and the camera. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens between Vera and the camera is the most significant, because Nina asked them to photo the whole trip because she's losing her memory.
Right.
And the camera serves as a memory keeper. And they all think of how this movie will be shown 10 or 5 years from now. So they are aware also about the future. The camera brings the point of time into the story. And Vera, who find it still very difficult to really come to terms with her daughter in my story, not in real life, that she prefers to talk to her in the camera, to the imagined daughter of her who is allegedly inside the camera, and rather to talk to her and not to the real Nina who sits next to her in the car, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the camera is both revealing and bereft from every pose or every disguise, but at the same time, it's exposing.
Yeah. And you write that Nina isn't here. She's gone, Nina. But in a way, that's Nina's contribution to the family, was her absence and return.
You just said it. Yeah. This is part of the rhythm, the disappearances and the coming back again.
Coming back together. The filmmaking device is really, I just loved it.
Thank you.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who have spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Israeli author David Grossman, whose new novel is More Than I Love My Life. He's joined in conversation by Rachel Handler. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Anonymous attendee says, what has it been like for you as a writer during the pandemic? And the subset on that is, would you write a story set in the pandemic?
Regarding the second question, I have no idea. As I said before, I mean, if there is a good idea that takes place in the time of the pandemic, I'll write it, but I will not force it. Mm-hmm. So many good books have been written of a pandemic, from Sophocles and Boccaccio and mm-hmm. The Plague by Albert Camus, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'll go there. The first closure, the first, how do you say?
Quarantine, lockdown?
Yeah, quarantine. It was sheer pleasure. I mean, everything slowed down. Everything became quiet. I spent most of my life actually alone in one room thinking and writing. So it was nothing new to me, the closure and the quarantine. But later it started to be annoying. There was a feeling of narrowing. You know, we lost contact with some people. We stopped going out for movies or theater. And there was a feeling that we become addicted to this narrowing, that there is something tempting and less demanding when you are isolating yourself totally. I'm very glad that this period is over, mm-hmm. I must say, and that we start to recover. Until the next virus, of course.
Right.
Well,
you make a very good point about Boccaccio and about Camus and about Journal of a Plague Year, that there is extant plague literature, extant pandemic literature. JCC Dallas says, most authors are avid readers. What are you reading now?
Well, I'm reading a book of a nonfiction book. Usually, I read only fiction of Philip Sand about the trials after the Second World War and about the terms of the genocide, for example. How was it created? And it's a fascinating book. It's called West East Street, Rehov Mizrach Ma'arav. But usually I read several books together. One is satisfying in for one thing, and others are in another thing. I'll not just drop names, but it evaded me. Sorry.
I know. It happens sometimes. You'll think of it in about an hour. So let's see. Bonnie Smith says, I believe you said that your person evolves and is affected with each new work you write. So how does this affect your relationships with your loved ones? So I think the question is, if you change as you write, how do the people around you respond to that? That's my interpretation of the question.
There's always a tension between writing and living in a family, because both of them are total experiences, and I want to be totally in both. I wouldn't give up on any one of them. And I think we all learned, my wife, my children, we all learned, myself, how to coexist with my strange creation tendencies. When the kids were small, it was harsher, you know, at 1 o'clock when they came back from kindergarten or school, and I had to close the computer, even if I was in a very euphoric feeling and I had to go and to warm up the schnitzel and the pasta spaghetti. But I love this too. I would like to live my life without the schnitzel and the pasta for my kids.
It's the writing life.
And I think there's something very arousing and uplifting in the fact that every 2-3 years, a new wave of people are pouring into our home and to our life, and we discuss it and we talk about it. My wife is a psychologist, so she works in a profession that is not far away from writing. And we discuss the characters and we speak about them. We have this institute of walking every morning at 5:45 in the morning. It's pitch dark, believe me, it's horrible. And and we walk and talk. It's a walkie-talkie friendship between us and another couple.
And it starts your day.
Yeah, very early I start my day.
Start your day. You know, you have spoken about writers as observers, and we kind of started our conversation today about observers and listeners, but you've spoken about writers as observers and of hope and of writing as a form of resistance. So I want to ask you kind of to wrap it up, to take us home, as we say, without giving away the ending, how does More Than I Love My Life take the characters and the readers into a hopeful space?
First, to see how an individual like Eva Panichnahir, like my Vera, stands in front of a total obliteration of his personality and survives it. How an individual can stand in front of a total arbitrariness and not to yield to it, not to give up on himself or herself, not to allow the outer arbitrariness change you or impose on you things that you will regret. And it's a great lesson. I learned a lot from that. But I also learned a lot from the relationship of Tiana and her mother. After all what they have gone through in their lives, yet they found a way to be together and to help each other and to love each other. And to be, I looked at it and there was something so flexible and so even, spiritual in the way that they, in their life, in a very practical way, they realized all the huge ideologies and the ideas. And they just practiced normal relationship of a mother and a child after a terrible trauma that they have suffered, and a lot of pain and a lot of remorse, and yet they found the way to be together. That was, I think, the greatest lesson that I will take from this book. I think it's so easy to subjugate to some power that acts upon you. And it takes so much power to act against the gravity of fear, the gravity of pain. And I think what writing taught me is that if you if you really surrender to writing, if you really allow yourself to think as the story leads you, then you find a way that you are not giving up, you are not defeated. I live in a climate here in Israel that I feel that so many people that I know declared defeatism and felt that nothing can be changed. We are doomed to live by the sword and to die by the sword. This will be like that forever. And even to think so for me is dangerous, because it means that you have really been defeated already, that you will have no way to change your situation, that you will continue to collaborate with evil and with hatred, that you will always be a victim. You can be very, very strong, like Israel is militarily very, very strong, and yet we are being defeated because we do not use all our might in order to change our situation, because we stopped believing in the option of living together with the Palestinian state, and two states, one next to the next, to the other. And this is one of the most tragic results of this ongoing situation of war, more than 100 years of animosity and hatred. And the things that peace can create and can solve are not only the territorial problems or the problems of the refugees or the problems of irrigation or whatever, but having peace will allow us really to be differently, to be in the world in a different way, to be without fear of existential danger that is hovering above our heads. And also we shall have a home. And I know it sounds strange, of course Israel is a home, but it's not enough a home. It's more like a fortress than a home. And it's home built on denial and suppress and oppressing another people. This will not work. And we need this home. So if we do not have home, the Palestinians will not have home. If they do not have home, we shall not have home. So all of this is entangled and tied up together. Sorry for this political speech. No,
don't apologize. David, you've inspired me in many ways today, both as a writer and as a citizen of the world, and all kinds of things. So don't apologize. You have inspired me, and I hope inspired our listeners as well. Is there anything else you want to tell me, David, before I let you go back to your writing world?
No, thank you for the conversation, for the very good questions.
This has been wonderful. I want to thank David and all of you for joining us today here. There's more exciting Book Festival in Your Living Room events ahead. Stay safe and healthy and stay tuned. And please, More Than I Love My Life by David Grossman, who has been our guest this afternoon. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Jessica. Shabbat shalom.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Israeli author David Grossman, whose new novel is More Than I Love My Life. He was joined in conversation by Rachel Handler. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.